Blog Talk Radio.
Every culture has its own artistic expression and contribution. Spirituality, art, and civilization are companions. Which one is the leader on this journey, I wonder? Our guest is Lena Aslan Dominique. Tonight on Main Street Universe. Join us in our circle.
The full moonlit nights, an infant cries in the great void of silence before we knew time. A miracle spawned the dawn of life. Hear all the stories of how we came to be. Our legends lived and our hero themes that share the secrets of our
and welcome to another Wednesday evening edition of Main Street Universe, the show reminding you that the mysteries and possibilities of the universe are closer to Main Street than you may have ever imagined. And I don't know about you, but I can imagine
a
whole lot. I am being joined this evening by hostess Janice.
Hello, everybody. Good evening.
And for those of you who have now become aware, I am standing right next to a drum kit, as I sometimes do as we do the show out of Cafe Fairfax, our recording studio here that my brother and I, the Reverend Scott Samuel Michael, built. And soon my music demo should be coming out of this thing as well, as we're getting a new computer in here, so there's a bit of a delay on my demo, but that'll be coming back very soon. In fact, I might be working on it this weekend. So, remember, I want to give everybody a reminder here, then we'll bring our guest on, that Main Street Universe is in fact a network of 5 shows. Wednesday evenings, the flagship show, Main Street Universe, co-founded by myself and Kevin Baird, and now Janice is the hostess.
Yep.
We've also had as co-hosts Brett Hillman, Melissa DeGenova, who was once a tour guide for the Witch Museum in Salem. And we as well have a show coming up on Fridays at midnight, every midnight, Activating Compassion in the Midnight Hour with Jesse Ann Nicholas George. She's the author of two books, Activating Compassion and Activating Compassion, the Companion Workbook. So that's Fridays at midnight. All these times are Eastern, by the way, folks. Jesse Ann Nichols, George, Activating Compassion. Then on Sundays, we have Darren Bouquet. Right now, the show is called Spiritual Insight That Soon Is Going to Change. Something with an angel theme, because part of his practice, Darren's a reader at Marie Laveau's House of Voodoo in the magical city of New Orleans. And part of Darren's practice is working with archangels, you know, Gabriel, Raphael, Uriel, and all of that. And he feels like, at least for now in the evolution of his show, that he wants to incorporate more angel imagery. So part of his thing is, you know, it's very Southern, you know, that mixture of metaphysical, right, a little, you know, witchcraft, voodoo, Christianity, all kind of melted together a little bit down there in New Orleans. So he wants to do more angelic themes with his readings and such. So it's Sunday evenings at 7 p.m. Eastern. And then Monday evenings at 9 p.m., sometimes 10 p.m. Eastern, is Kevin Baird, Walking on the Sidewalk. Kevin is the creator of the Horizon Oracle cards. This is a oracle deck that he created by himself. And after years and years of reading the tarot, he decided to do something a little different and take it upon himself to create his own cards. There's 111 of them in this thing. And you can find out more about Kevin as well as his artwork on www.templeofgaia.com. Tuesdays, we have Inner Wisdom with Mary Thielen. Mary is the hostess of Telepathic TV. And that has been on the air here for about 14 years in Northern Virginia. And that is co-hosted with Neville Johnston, who is the author of many, many books. And I enjoyed his language and use of language book. I thought maybe it was one of his more interesting ones. I really like that one. So that's five shows on the network, and soon to possibly be six.
Six.
As well as soon to be seven.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, we've got some things going on here, because Janice will be doing
World Reggae
Party.
Yeah, World Reggae Party.
Which he does here locally in Radio Fairfax.
Yes. Well, and you can also find me on Facebook, www.facebook.com/goddessjanice.com, I believe, or something similar to that.
So Goddess Janice on Facebook and doing her show, The World Reggae Party. And Thursdays, we're going to start doing a show, and this guy records it. It's a pre-recorded show, super professional-sounding show. You've met him on Facebook, Janice. His name is Nathan Lane, and his show is called Appalachian Strangeness. And it's a whole bunch of things about hauntings and strange going on in southwestern Virginia. So I imagine eventually the topics would have to expand beyond that, but right now it's Appalachian Strangeness, and his show sounds amazing. It's really well done. He's very professional, and he's really trying to break into the voiceover world and audio work, which I am
Aren't
as
we
well.
All?
Yes.
Aren't we all?
That's what we're all doing.
That's what we're all doing.
In
trying
part.
To break in.
That's right. And he figured it would be better to be part of a little co-op like this, like Mystery Universe is, to help pump up his ratings. And ours as well, because we'll draw in some of his people and all that. So we're thinking maybe Thursday evenings for that show. His show's only like a half hour, 35 minutes, something like that. So we can squeeze it into many different places and move it around, since it won't be a live show. It won't depend as much on callers and things like that.
Yes.
So anyway, we're growing and growing and growing, and we'll potentially be a seven-show network within a few weeks. So we're working it all out right now.
We're working it all out.
So tonight, our guest is Helena Dominic, and I'm going to go ahead, instead of me talking about her, why don't I just bring her on and wait for the symbol, and there's your symbol. Hello, Helena.
Hi. Hi, well, how are you?
I am doing well. It's a beautiful evening here.
Beautiful evening. Kind of warm for April, but still beautiful.
Yes.
Yeah, definitely a great day.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, I guess I want to start right off with a few plugs of what you're working on currently, Helena, and that would be your website. Would you like to give out your website information?
Sure. My website is www.mythandwonder.com. No slashes or anything in between that. You can find my art there as well as my tarot deck and other stuff.
Yes.
So So, and you're asking what am I working on currently?
Well, I was just going to plug the few things, including you have a Kickstarter campaign, right?
Well, Indiegogo, which actually the Indiegogo campaign ended. I may do another one. I'm giving it a bit of time because I have a lot of friends who are doing Indiegogo campaigns. And people get fundraising fatigue, you know. campaign, so I'm kind of waiting on that before I do another one. But yeah, that helped me to actually print 500 copies of the deck so that I was able to, you know, distribute it more widely than I had been. So that was very helpful.
All right. What I'd like to do is I'll start off this interview and then I'll hand you over to your longtime friend Janice over here.
Okay.
And basically, I want to get first into more of the metaphysical aspects, and then maybe Janice will dive into the artistic aspects a little bit. So what I want to start right off, of course, they're both all swimming together. I understand that.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd like to start off by mentioning the deck itself, the Fellowship of the Fool. And what was your inspiration for wanting to create a new tarot deck?
I had actually, over the past, say, 10 years or so, 10 or 15 years, had some stops and starts with creating a deck. And I had actually created a deck of majors about, 12 or 15 years ago. And that was really fun, and that was more of a storybook sort of illustrative thing that I had done. And then I went to graduate school, so I never really did anything with it. I actually wrote a storybook, and I had illustrations that could be published as cards, I suppose, too. But I went off to graduate school, and that sort of got put aside for the first time. And then I, you know, as an artist do, I was working on lots of other paintings. And every once in a while, I would do, you know, say a Queen of Cups or a Queen of Wands or something like that. And I always fooled around with the idea of really going back to it. And then when I decided to go back to it, because I've loved the tarot for many, many years, and I've taught tarot for many years, and so, you know, I had many people coming up to me saying, you know, you're an artist, you should have a deck, you know, you should do this, and you love the cards so much. So I finally decided to get it together and do that, and that coincided with me going back to graduate school for my MFA. And I was actually able to work the creation of the deck into my study plan for my MFA, which was really great. And so that helped a lot. And the deck is really a reflection of, it's called the Fellowship of the Fool because it's a reflection of my world. You know, I had almost everyone in the deck, with the exception of maybe two or three cards, as someone that I know personally, as a friend, a family member, a colleague at work, one of my students. So it is very personal to me in that way, although it was, you know, it's also a challenge to create a deck that other people will want to use, too, that is so personal to you. But I think I've been successful in that. People seem to like the images. So I guess that's a long answer to your question.
But that's okay. We have plenty of time. And it's funny that it is the Fellowship of the Fool, because they usually say, and you might be aware of this, Elena, that when you are first learning the tarot, and even beyond that, but this is often a conversation amongst people first learning the tarot, especially if they're around each other, like you got a couple of friends that are learning it about the same time, is there oftentimes becomes this one card that pops out at you all the time.
So
my
friend,
it was the Hermit. It just kept coming up over and over and over again. So that kind of becomes like your card, like the tarot's trying to tell you that this is your thing to work on. Mine was the Fool, actually.
Mine was the Star.
Mm-hmm. So I just kept over and over getting the Fool, starting over, but they're still being the brave adventurer and all the qualities that go with the Fool, which was something I needed. I was living not even successfully, but still being a little too safe. And I needed that quality of, hey, let's just go jump off the mountain a little bit. So I'm curious if you had a card similar to that, and maybe it was a Fool, I don't know, when you were first starting to read tarot.
I think there's a everybody has a card like that for sure. And a card that they're drawn to, I think, naturally too. I think for me, the card that still comes up for me all the time is the Queen of Cups, which I'm a Cancer, and that card I think also represents people who are Cancers.
Very watery.
Yeah, very watery and very much me. So I identify with that a lot. And the High Priestess I identify with a lot as well. Yeah, and everybody kind of has their go-to card that, you know, if they're trying to buy a deck, you know, they're like, well, what does their High Priestess look like, or what does their star look like before they'll decide if they want that deck, you know?
And it's, for me, now, of course, there's so many tarot decks out there, you know, for those that know, there's a lot, there's a baseball one, I think.
Yeah.
And for me, when I first was learning, I had the Rider-Waite. I didn't have the Rider-Waite Standard. I had the Rider-Waite Radiant. I still have it. It's still my primary.
Mm-hmm.
It's somebody, some teacher I was learning from is like, is that the deck you're going to show them when they show up? That, you know, like it's blah, blah, blah. It's boring. But even though I still think that the, you know, I have different decks now. I have Oracle decks. I have Halloween Tarot. I have a bunch of, you know, different ones out there now. But, and Horizon Oracle as well. But I still think that the Rider-Waite High Priestess is one of the prettiest tarot cards.
It is.
I just love that card.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, yeah, me too.
Very much. I have 8 decks myself, Helena. Well, 9.
Oh, wow.
I have yours now.
Mm-hmm. Oh, very good.
Oh, she brought it.
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know she brought it over. No, sitting right on the table.
Yeah.
I have,
yeah,
seen
I have
one of the images that I did post for the show's marquee page, so it's in one of the pictures.
Thanks.
Now, there's a book that accompanies this as well. Now, for the audience, is this an instructional book for the tarot or a storybook related to it?
It is an instructional book, and it is applicable to the Fellowship of the Pool specifically, but I also tried to write it so that if you don't know anything about the tarot, you could certainly pick it up and learn about the tarot as well as the deck.
Okay. And another thing I would say is your full image there you have on the front page, as Jesus Niece is handing it to me,
mm-hmm.
and it's part of the image on the show's marquee page. One thing that's unique about it is interesting that it's a female character, of course,
mm-hmm.
and it's interesting to see the different takes people do. When I used to do an intro for the show, I used to start out with the major arcana and tell the story sort of very quickly as a show intro whenever I did one when we were doing readings. And I would swap back and forth between saying he and she as the fool starting off on the journey. And anyway, the inspiration for the fool card, the jumping off the mountain, and you have the girl there and the dog, what was your primary motivation for making this character at first female?
Well, the whole deck, I wanted it to be very multicultural, and I wanted it to not, I wanted to honor the tarot traditions that were established already, you know, some of the, so a lot of the imagery is some imagery and symbolism that you would see in the Rider-Waite deck. Especially because I'm a fan of Pamela Coleman Smith, who was the illustrator of that deck. And if you know her story, it becomes a lot more meaningful if you know something about her. And so I was trying to incorporate some of her imagery, but also to make the deck relevant to the 21st century. So one of the ways that I did that was to change the assigned gender, as it were, or traditional assigned gender of some of the cards. And then in the court cards, I changed it up as well so that it didn't matter what the gender of the individual was being read for. So that instead of being page, knight, king, and queen, I was using the names for the medieval guilds as people would work their ways through the trades, and also not just medieval guilds, but also magical societies. So my court cards are the apprentice, the journeyman, the master, and the adept. So that could be either male or female. I wanted it to be, interchangeable, so it could be open to interpretation.
Right. And I think that was part of the answer I was almost looking for when I asked that question.
Okay.
It was a broad question, but you mentioned, well, the Rider-Waite image we're so used to was drawn by a female. So why not have have the opening card be the female image?
I've always liked the idea of a female fool, I guess. And, you know, I'm a woman, and that's, that card represents the beginning of the journey, and in a way that card was the beginning of my journey, and I'm a female, so there you go.
And it is, and there is almost something almost like humorously attached to when you think the fool, there is something about it, is why I asked this question. You do kind of think of a guy, right? You think of some guy fumbling, bumbling, stumbling around, just bebopping around, doing whatever he's doing, doesn't have a clue. So in a way, it both humanizes the female as well as giving it a bit of respect and dignity and all of that, and an interesting equality, you might say.
Oh, well, thanks.
And so I also found it interesting that you said that these were actually part of, these were full-size, like, large paintings first, or a lot of them were, maybe not all of them.
Yeah, they actually are all about 9 by 12.
Okay.
Yeah, so not huge, you know, but it's easier to paint something that's that size and then shrink it down than it is to try to paint something that's card-sized, you know, unless, you know, you're very young and you have very good eyes.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, included, since we're talking about a tarot deck, and we'll get back to art more, I'm keeping it a little bit more metaphysical now again. Let's get into a little bit of some of your other metaphysical practices. It mentions Kabbalah, amongst other things. So I'm curious, as a child, we talked a little about art. When did you first start thinking metaphysically, magically?
Probably, I was raised Roman Catholic, you know, so that was, that's obviously what have shaped my early experiences as a kid, and I was always very interested in kind of the unusual experiences that one could have in the church, the ones that weren't necessarily encouraged, you know, and I was always interested in the saints who would have mystical unions with God, you know, like St. Teresa of Avila and people like that who had visions and things like that. I found that really fascinating. And, of course, in the 20th century, there's not much room for that, you know, in the Catholic Church. So I think it was maybe in junior high I stumbled on a book about kind of everything. It was a book that included information about astrology, information about tarot, and I was immediately fascinated and wanted to, this was in the 70s, you know, so there wasn't, if you were a kid in the 70s, there wasn't a whole lot to find, or if you didn't know where to look, you know, so
true.
I kind of read that book a lot when I was in junior high, and then you know, my family tried to steer me back more to, you know, more proper Catholic practices and so forth. So I kind of, you know, put those things away for a while. And then, of course, like a lot of people do, I found my way back to it in college, you know. And that was when I, you know, really got into it. My dad actually, of all people, my dad is now a very devout Christian, so it's really ironic. He brought home a book from the library called Witches by Erica Jong, which is still available. It's like a big, beautifully illustrated coffee table book with really beautiful paintings in it and poetry that Erica Jong wrote. And, you know, it's all talks a lot about the maiden and the mother and the crone, and it talks about women and feminist issues and the burning times and things like that. And so I found it very interesting. And within that book, I found in the bibliography a book called Drawing Down the Moon, and I think she cited that book a number of times throughout the text, and I was like, oh, that's an interesting, you know, thing. I think I need to go and, you know, look that up. And so that was kind of how I stumbled my way into Wicca, I guess you could say, was through that.
And I recently, go ahead, please.
Oh, I was just going to say, and, you know, kind of got back into that, which was metaphysical and all of that. You know, it was sort of like finding that part of myself again.
Yes, and it is it's a fascinating feeling. You know, I've been through that journey, and so has Janice here herself. And I was a kid in the 70s, too. I'm 42 years old now. And Janice is like 29 or something over there.
Yeah, yeah,
and,
29.
And it was, in certain part of the country, is very hard to find any kind of good. You could if you really knew where to look. You had to really find that, like, you'd have to know your way around, like maybe really know your way around the city. And, oh, there's that little occult bookstore somewhere. And certain parts of the country even more so than others.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
For myself, I actually, what was kind of funny, I found old, this is how limited it was. I went into, with my interest in magic and everything, and having astral projections and everything, I wanted to explore it. I go into the library, and I just start picking up old dictionaries and looking up, like, the word witch, you know, sorcerer. It was actually, I found an old English dictionary one time and actually found the word Wicca. You know, rare old Anglo dictionaries happened to be there. And then I just started finding books. A lot of them were against witchcraft. They were from warning us about it. But even then, sometimes you got little interesting bits of information. But you were piecing together all this little stuff from all these different little
ways.
And then occasionally you'd find a friend that had a tarot card deck or knew a little something. And everybody's piecing together. That's how it was for me. Everybody was piecing together all this little stuff.
Oh,
until
cool.
information became more available,
yeah.
of course.
Yeah. And now it's everywhere.
Yes, it is.
Now it's there. Yes,
yeah. Wicca's even in the dictionary for real now. So.
Yeah.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. I'll have to go. Next time at the bookstore, I'll have to go take a peek.
The one I found it in was the old Anglo-Saxon Bosworth Toller dictionary. I mean, you know, way back when. And there were college dictionaries that had some old English references and stuff like that. That was back in the day. But anyway, you also, it says, are interested in Kabbalah. I'm curious how you came across Kabbalah.
Well, Kabbalah I didn't really get into until, I joined the assembly of the Sacred Wheel. And that is something that we use a lot in our own practices. And what really hooked me on Kabbalah was the connection to tarot, and I find that my study of one enhances my study of the other, and you know, one informs the knowledge of the other. So it's been very useful to me.
And I'm wondering if I can ask you a question. If you don't know the answer to this, then please. I understand it's something there's debate on. Now,
okay.
I haven't used Kabbalah much in my tarot practice.
Mm-hmm.
But I have heard that there's different arguments, different schools of thought as to where to start the Kabbalah symbols. I'll give you an example. From the Order of the Golden Dawn, that his name is Mathers, if I'm saying his name right.
Mm-hmm.
He had a Kabbalah
Mathers,
book
yeah.
where it starts off with a certain thing, like with the fool. And other people start the symbols off, or the Kabbalistic, you know, characters off and language off, differently, like some start them at the fool, some start them at the magician. Have you ever heard that or heard the arguments of that?
Yeah, there are different, it's really interesting. What I always say is pick the way that makes the most sense to you and go with it. You know, I tend to go with the Golden Dawn system because that's the one I was initially introduced to. And it and maybe that's why it makes sense to me. I don't really have a terrific answer for why that is. But the truth is, they all kind of work. So I think in magic, the rule is if you keep following the same path over and over, that path gets more well-worn and easier to tread for you. So my advice is to pick the one that works for you and go with it. Like, for example, Aleister Crowley, in the Kabbalah, they for those who don't know, on the Tree of Life, there are paths that you take, and this is actually where we get the term pathworking, and that's where you're following these paths. And the place where he puts the star is different from where other people at the Star, and I actually started working with the Thoth Tarot and thought, well, this will be really interesting, and I started reading his book to go with it, and I was just like, oh, this shakes my universe up too much. I can't do it. You know, so it's really, but somebody else might be a lot more flexible than I am on that, you know, so it kind of depends on, you know, on where you're at and what works for you, you know.
I agree.
I feel like I'm hearing the screams of 1,000 Thelemites right now, but
I had one on our show a while back.
But pick what works for you and stick with it would be my advice.
Yeah, and I agree. But and I was surprised because I wanted to up my tarot game a little, and
mm-hmm.
I was like, okay, I'm really going to start focusing on the Kabbalistic aspects, and I kept running into mm-hmm. all these debates on which one. So I guess, yeah, like you said, that was the first one I found, the Golden Dawn one. I might as well just run with that,
mm-hmm.
right?
And that's probably the one that you're going to find, aside from Aleister Crowley, because there's been so much information written about him and about his systems, you could probably find a lot about his work as well. But probably Golden Dawn has the most information and most easily accessible, I would imagine.
Yes, and a great website. Though I could be giving away, no, I was kidding. But one great website for looking up great old metaphysical and occult texts, in case you don't have the book or something like that, or don't have a metaphysical store,
mm-hmm.
is sacredtext.com.
Oh, that is a great one.
That is a great book. I love that
yeah.
website.
That is a great website.
You can find so many interesting things,
mm-hmm.
you know, like the great alchemists like Cornelius Agrippa with his occult philosophy and all that. You can find all these great occult classics there. And
it seems to get bigger all the time.
Yeah.
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 Well, and from there, we had a guest recently, just out of a curiosity, and then I'll hand you over to Janice, who's a Kabbalah expert. She's been studying it her whole life. Maybe you've heard of her, maybe you haven't. Her name is Dr. Zoe Hieronymus. Have you ever heard of her?
Mm-hmm. Interesting name, though.
Yes, Zohara Meyerhoff Hieronymus. She's related to the Hoffs with the Symphony Hall there.
In Baltimore.
Yeah, Baltimore family. And her book
mm-hmm.
was called Sanctuary of the Divine Presence. I recommend it to people. She was going to call it The Seven Prophetesses, but she thought people would have a problem saying the word prophetesses over and over again fast. So, anyway, just curious if you'd heard of her. Something to look up, maybe. But
cool.
What I'm going to do here real quick, we've been on the air now for about, well, more than a half hour. Went by pretty quick.
Yeah, wow, that is fast.
We still have some more time to go. I'm going to take a brief break with a quick song and then come right back, and then we'll delve into art,
yes.
As well as how it affects civilization and metaphysical and magic and all the things that intertwine and swim together,
yeah.
And the light and stardust and all the stuff that makes us all up in vibrating energy and all that fun stuff. So anyway, this next song is from a band who did the first song. That band is called Woven Green. They're actually friends of ours. All the music here is from people we know. And this song is called The Sixth Sun.
everybody. We're back, and that's
our friends Woven Green, who may be the backup musicians for my album, my demo that I'm going to be working on. For those of you that know me, I'm a musician, and we're back. We've been talking to Helena Dominique, and before we move on, I want to go ahead and just mention our network again and then get back to the interview. Right now, you're listening to Main Street Universe, 7 p.m. Eastern Time, our flagship show, myself and Janice.
Hello.
We're here every week, 7 p.m. Eastern Time. It's the show I co-founded with Kevin Baird, who now does our Monday evening show, Monday at 9 or 10 o'clock, walking on the sidewalk. Kevin is the creator of the Horizon Oracle deck, a group of Oracle cards that he himself created through his dreams and visions and other things. And Kevin can be reached at www.templeofgaia.com. Friday evenings, midnight, we have Jesse Ann Nichols George as our host, and the show is Activating Compassion in the Midnight Hour. Jesse is the author of two books, Activating Compassion and Activating Compassion, the Companion Workbook. 12 midnight. And soon coming on our show will be the amazing New Age musician, Steve Halpern, if you're familiar with him.
Yeah, on Friday's show.
Absolutely.
Very excited about that.
Put out a lot of music out there over the years. Great to have him on Main Street Universe and on Activating Compassion. On Sunday evening, 7 p.m., we have Darren Bouquer. He's a reader at Marie Laveau's House of Voodoo in the magical city of New Orleans.
Yeah.
Darren will be opening phone lines to take calls and readings. It's one of those reading shows, but he also discusses a topic for a little bit as well. And we'll be working on that. It's very hot in here, isn't it? I'm going to be working on that in just a minute. It's a studio. We're in a soundproof studio, and I think the AC is not on, and we're starting to feel this.
Trust me, Helena, it's very hot in here.
I'm so sorry.
7, Sunday, Darren Bouquer, and then, of course, our final show, Tuesdays, our only AM show, Inner Wisdom with Mary Phelan, 11:30 a.m. on Tuesdays. Mary is the hostess of a television show that's been on the air for 14 years.
Telepathic TV.
With our other host, Mr. Neville Johnston. So, Janice, I'm handing it over to you while I take care of a couple technical things.
All right. Hello again, Helena. How are you?
I am good. How are you?
Hot, but other than that, I'm fine.
I'm so sorry.
That's okay. It's that 90-degree weather that we're having, so.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
Yes, yes. But I wanted to take over the art side of it, because, you know, first of all, I have four of your paintings, and this big star, the star, because, you know, I'm an Aquarian, so star is my card, and the Fellowship of the Fool that you just recently gave me, so I was thinking, hey, I'll do the art, so, but I do have a physical question or two after we finish the art. Now, for our listeners out there, Helena is an associate professor of fine arts at Cheney University in Cheney, Pennsylvania, which is near Philadelphia, if I remember right, because I used to live in Philadelphia. And that you teach art history, African art, drawing, and watercolor. And you're also the director of Biddle Hall Art Gallery.
The gallery.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So my questions, I'm going to start with on your bio, you were saying that you were born in Felicia, Italy.
Vicenza,
right?
Yes.
Yes.
Vicenza, Italy, yes.
Yes, which is on my travel list. Italy alone, you know, that's three or four places in Italy that's on my travel list. So I wanted to know how being born in Italy has shaped your past, present, and future art. Because you were saying that you went to the Sistine Chapel at 18 months, which I find that quite interesting because I can't remember anything I did in 18 months.
Well, I don't remember it consciously, but I always mention it because my mom always remembered it because she said I was fascinated by it, and my dad said that when, as soon as we walked into the chapel, my eyes popped open and I went, you know, and so I think that, and I kept saying, pretty, pretty. Mm-hmm. So I think that exposure to that must have affected me in some way.
Okay.
And my parents, you know, we were in Italy for 3 years, and we came home with all of these art books, and they were things that from my childhood that I still have that I really pored over and loved and looked at again and again, these pictures. And they were just really precious to me, the pictures of the Sistine Chapel ceiling and the sculptures of Michelangelo and the paintings of Da Vinci. And it's probably why I became an art historian. And and I probably part of developing a good visual memory, which makes me a good art historian. And so I think that's one of the ways that it really shaped me. And I have not, sadly, been back to Italy, but I want to go back, and I'm sure that going back will shape my future art. And I certainly, in my teaching, the Renaissance is such a big thing, and I think having had that exposure to the Renaissance art at such an early age, is something that I carry into my teaching and emphasize techniques that artists used and things like that. So it's very dear to my heart and always will be.
Yes, I was going to ask you, have you been to Italy recently, or how many times have you been there?
Yeah, embarrassingly, just then. I hope to get back, you know, as an adult. I've been to the UK, and I've been to Ireland, but I have not been back there yet.
Well, maybe we should go together, because this is definitely on my list. I think
that would be
number
great.
Two. With number one, going back to Egypt, which you're going in January, if I remember right.
Yes, I am. That is correct.
Yes.
Yes.
Have you been to Africa at all?
Funny, my family, we were part of why we were in Italy is because we were a military family. My dad was stationed there as part of a rescue effort. There was a huge landslide in 1963, and it buried a village. And so my dad was there as part of an Army Red Cross cleanup effort. And so that's why we were there. And we were also in Ethiopia, where my brother was born. And I don't remember what the mission was for that. But that was actually before I was born. But we had all these objects in the house from Ethiopia when I was growing up. So I think that kind of fueled some of my interest. But what's interesting is I did not actually become an expert, if you will, if we could call me that, on African art until I started teaching at Cheney, and they really wanted me to teach the African art courses there. And so part of my going back to graduate school was to pick up that specialty, and I really fell in love with it. So I am looking forward to being able to go in January, and part of my interest, as you know, is in Nubia. And that is one of the places that we'll be visiting. So that will be very cool.
That's where the you were talking about Nubia. You had finished talking about it when the picture was taken of us at Sacred Space, which I think is a very cool picture.
Yeah, I like that picture too.
Yes. So I want to ask you a couple questions about Cheney.
Because
I read on Facebook today that there's a little bit of controversy.
I don't want to speak to it too much because I don't have permission from the student involved. But what I can say is what arose was I can speak to general issues such as in Islam there is a prohibition against being able to show figures. You don't show figures, which is why so much Islamic art is filled with calligraphy and lots of vegetative design and floral design and things like that. Flowers, exactly. And you never depict the Prophet Muhammad or anybody sacred ever. So I've always wondered, I've had a lot of Muslim students in the past, and I always figured someone would say something to me if they had an issue. What I can say is today someone did. So I'm hoping to get more information about that and see what happens. Yeah, but the first time in 10 years that's ever happened.
Wow.
So, yeah.
Interesting that it wouldn't happen today.
But,
yeah, I know, right?
Yeah, but I won't ask anything else about that because it's private. But
yeah,
I did see on Facebook again about your students making their own African mask.
Mm-hmm.
And for people who don't know, Cheney University is a predominantly African-American university. So what did it feel like to help them create their own mask or be a part of them creating their own mask today? And could you tell me about
really
your
fun.
African art classes in general?
Yeah, it's something I really enjoy. It can be complicated on a number of issues because I am Caucasian, you know. But the students never seem to mind that. You know, the students seem to be happy to be receiving information. I no one has ever said anything to me directly. Sometimes I have overheard little things, but nobody's ever said, you know, like they think a black professor should be teaching the courses, which, you know, perhaps if that's how they feel, they should, you know, go find someone with similar credentials. I don't know. But I do have the information and I am able to impart it, and the students seem to appreciate that. And part of the assignment for creating the mask is to kind of take what we've learned in class. Because one of the complaints I get in art history all the time, especially in recent years, because as you probably know, art is not emphasized in the schools anymore, in the public schools. So they don't experience art making on a regular basis frequently. So they come to college and they might take an art course with the expectation that they're going to make art, and then they find out, oh, wow, it's an art history course, and all I'm going to do is write papers, and wow, that's really dull. So part of doing the mask making is to try to bring some art making into it, and also to help them embody some of what they're seeing in the slide lectures and in the books. And you know, see what it's like to try to create, you know, a three-dimensional object, mm-hmm. you know, that, you know, for them, hopefully will be something that they'll want to take with them when they graduate and will be, you know, something that will be a good memory of their college years, you know. And a lot of them really seem to enjoy the project and want to, the ones that go on to become teachers, which a lot of them do, take it with them and, you know, impart that then to their students. So that is really fun, and I really enjoy that. And a lot of the students, as you've probably seen from some of the pictures, really, really get into it.
Yeah, the ones I saw for that particular class really looked really professionally done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this year, I have to say, is probably the best year so far. I have a giant King Tut mask, life-sized King Tut mask that an older non-traditional couple did together, which is really amazing. Yeah, I think it's up on Facebook. I'll have to see if I put the finished version. I might not have gotten that up there yet. And let's see. And there's another guy who it's not quite finished because they're getting very complex and doing really cool stuff. He's doing a Sanufo Kupinyungo mask, which is this mask that has a huge sort of snout that comes out with tusks and teeth, and it's, you know, really wild looking. Mm-hmm. So it's really cool to see them, like, taking it and figuring out how to visualize it and then how to make it real.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What compels you to create African art? Is it because you had your childhood in Ethiopia, or?
I don't know if I would call what I do African art since I'm American, but I would say I'm attracted to it. I'm attracted to all indigenous practices, I think.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because right now my own artistic practice is more doing paintings. Mm-hmm. And often doing paintings, as you know, of goddesses and that kind of thing. Although right now I'm doing a series on indigenous women. So I've got a big painting that I'm doing right now of a Yoruban woman, and I did a series of paintings of Esau, the Mayan priestess, and the Aztec.
Yeah, I'd like to ask
woman. I will get to your email.
Yes.
Thanks. And I'm working on a painting of a Maori woman right now.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm interested, kind of like, I guess it's sort of springing off some of the ideas in the tarot, that I like to see a multicultural world. And so I want my paintings to be reflective of that.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's nothing wrong with that. Now, your creation of a multicultural world has compelled you to see Egypt. I know you are planning to go to Egypt, and I've been
mm-hmm.
to Egypt. I went in 2010. That's when I went, and I want to go back.
Mm-hmm.
I can't afford to go back now, but I do want to
mm-hmm.
go back. So has that compelled you to maybe look at Nubian art when you go, or...
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. We're going to visit a Nubian village when we're there. So that will be really awesome. And some of the temples that we'll be seeing will be in Nubia.
Yes.
So, yes.
Cool. You haven't lived until you've been either in a sandstorm or got inside a pyramid, and I've done both.
Oh, wow.
So...
Wow. I'm afraid of going inside a pyramid. I have to be truthful.
Let me to actually tell you anything about it. just let me know. But one thing, please,
okay.
please bring a scarf. That's all I have to say.
Oh, I will.
So bring a scarf.
I'll bring a few.
Yes.
Yeah.
Is there a spiritual process that you go through before you create your art?
Like a ritual?
Sometimes. It's
like a ritual
really
or routine?
I don't know if I would call it. I guess other people might call it a ritual. What I might do, it depends on what how it comes to me, if you will. If something just comes to me, and sometimes an image will just come to me, I just get it out, and I put it down, and I do it, and the act of painting itself in a way becomes like a ritual for me.
Mm-hmm.
And then sometimes if I have something that I can't quite get out and I want it to come out, then what I will do is consciously try to meditate and speak to the image and maybe begin the process of a sketch and ask it to make it more clear to me, make itself more clear to me, and try to dialogue with it in that way. If that makes sense.
That makes sense. The reason...
For those listening, I just want to say real quick that one or two of our images are on our marquee floating around. Our other phone just stopped working, folks, so I had to jump over here. Sorry, Janine.
That's all right. The reason why I asked that is that I met you in 2008, but I didn't really get to see your work or buy any of your pictures until the room. And I'm saying it slowly so I don't mess it up in my tongue. But so can you talk a little bit about the womb room?
The womb room. Okay,
yes.
Sure. Yeah, that was also part of my graduate school experience.
Mm-hmm.
That was we had to do a project that was community oriented. And so my idea was to use my art to create an atmosphere and a space in which people could come and receive readings. So that way I also brought the tarot into it as well. And they could also go in and meditate if they wanted and just hang out and, you know, have a private conversation over whatever they wanted. And so the room itself was constructed. I did very large silk panel paintings, which basically when you paint on silk, you stretch it out on a huge, well, whatever size stretcher you're doing for the size silk that you're working on, and you use a special dye,
mm-hmm.
and you have to use resist around certain places or everything, you know, because it's silk, it's fabric, everything runs into everything else. So I was creating sort of womb-like images. Some of them were womb-like, some of them were more like roots in the ground and things growing type images, and some of them were egg images. And then I worked to kind of construct the panels into a room. I think at I did it at Between the Worlds 1 year, Between the Worlds in Wilmington. And with that one, I actually, yeah, I did it at Sacred Space too. At Between the Worlds, I used a one of those tent frames to construct it for people to come in. And at Sacred Space, I actually took double-sided scrapbooking tape, because it peels off really easily, and just stuck the silk directly on the walls and hung it from the ceilings as well.
I remember it being very pink.
Womb.
Yeah. Very pink.
Yeah.
So creating that womb room.
Yeah. And then Eva Dominguez composed music for me. Yeah, I wanted it to be multisensory, so you had the visual with the, you know, the silks and all of that, and also tactile, because you can touch the silk and it has a certain feel to it, and auditory, so we had the music playing, and olfactory, I had incense. And at some point I was going to make tea, but that never quite happened, so that we didn't get the taste in there. But anyway, I was trying to go along with the idea that it was also a ritual space, because ritual also activates all the senses.
That's so true.
Yes. Yeah.
Which provides me with another question. How has your art provided you with a built-in spiritual base?
Oh, wow. I think my art is, more and more I'm realizing that being a visually based person is the core part of my spiritual practice, because I never realized it before, but ironically, you know, I'm the one doing it, but I never realized it. There's a book out called Magical Thought Forms, The Use of Magical Thought Forms by Dolores Ashcroft Nowicki. And it's all about using your visual abilities and your imagination to do magic. And I thought, oh my God, I've been doing this since I was 5. I had no idea. So it's critical for me to be able to do that. And I think some of my more abstract paintings are more like portals, you know, maybe into other places. And I think some of my more portrait-like pieces are places where spirits can reside. So, and that's always evolving, you know, what that means. And sometimes for different people, they mean different things. People see things in the pieces that are important to them, and that might not mean anything to me at all, but as an artist you have to be prepared for that. But I think it's everything to my spiritual practice, and vice versa to my artistic practice.
Right. And this is Dan Michael again, and I wanted to comment on when you mentioned the visual and things that you see, things that you can use in visualization, especially in the proper mind state or the proper vibration, how they can manifest into something real. The interesting thing about that is with the new sciences coming out, sort of catching up with the physics and magic, such as in quantum mechanics, they say that the light that you see coming into your eyes go all the way back to your brain, to the back of the brain, and then project back out to tell you what you're seeing. So basically what is meant by this is that the light scientifically that exists outside in the world is the same as the light that exists when you imagine it. It's still an energy particle. It still exists.
Mm-hmm.
So it has sort of the as within, so without principle. It's scientifically energy. So now science is beginning to catch up with this idea of the visualizing magic, as you mentioned.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, cool.
Very cool.
They'll know our secrets now.
No, there's no more secrets.
Right.
Oh, what was this child bride thing? I was reading the Fellowship of the Fool, and it was child bride a couple times. What is that about?
Where's that?
Child bride. And it was in the first and I think second chapter where you kept calling yourself a child bride.
Oh, a child bride? Oh, that's my joke of course I can't possibly be nearing 50. I was only, I was married. You
know. Oh, I was like, oh, that was something I didn't know.
I was
know.
Only 12.
Oh.
Yeah, that's right. I can't possibly be as old as I am.
I think that every day, but, you know, I just turned 29. Remember, Daniel told
right,
you.
Right.
Some bro, I'm like, mm.
You got to reach for that.
I'm kind of reaching myself, actually. So, you know, Evo's coming on May 1st to talk to us.
Oh, awesome.
Yes.
Awesome. I'll be sure to tune in.
Yes. And, you know, I've known him for 15 years, and I can't believe I know him that long.
Time, it does fly.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I've known him since 1985-ish, 86, 85, 86, so I don't even want to do the math on that.
It's a good thing for you, I'm horrible at math.
Yeah, me too.
It was 88 when I met him, so maybe it's not quite.
Okay. Yeah, that's. I think you're bad at math, too.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I think I am, too. Yeah. So, but, no, 88 and 15 is, yeah, 15 years.
No more math on the air.
Yeah.
Okay, I've been warned, no more math in the air.
Okay.
Can you tell us a little bit about your friendship with Evo?
Oh, wow. Well, let's see. Well, we met when I first got out of college in 1985. And I had, you know, as I said, I had tracked down Drawing Down the Mood by Margot Adler, and I was very fascinated with it. And I lived in Claymont, Delaware at the time, which Claymont is a teeny, teeny, teeny town. It's so teeny, it's not even doesn't even qualify as a town. I'm not sure what they've even designated it as, but it's not even qualified as a town. And so I came home from college, and I was afraid that I wouldn't be able to meet anybody that would have this interest, you know. But I had a friend who owned a bookstore in Claymont called Between Books, and he actually at the when I knew him earlier. It was sort of a D&D gaming store, and I went in to visit him, and suddenly he had all these books on neo-paganism and Wicca and so forth, and I was like, oh, you're into that. Wow, do you know anybody? And he was like, well, as a matter of fact, I know these people that are going to be doing this circle on such and such a night, and if you come meet us at such and such a time, you know, you can go with us. And that was how I met Evo, you know, and that was... I believe the circle was in on his Jim Welch's grandmother's farm, which she used to own in, I want to say, what I'm not very good on parts of Delaware anymore, but I think it was around southern Wilmington. It's no longer there, actually, sadly. But there we had, that was the first time I met them, and it just felt like coming home. You know, it was very cool, and I joined Keepers of the Holly Chalice not too long after that, and actually I did what a lot of people do. I had a really bad first marriage, and I left Keepers for a period of time, but when that marriage ended, I went back. You know,
okay.
And they welcomed me back, which was really awesome, and. You know, and I've been solid ever since. That was around the end of 1990 into 1991. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, it's Daniel. Hold on.
Mm-hmm.
The other microphone is down, so
okay.
I don't do this too often. But I've noticed a few times, actually, I think both of you are using the term, and people of a certain generation using the terms coming home, welcome home. And I remember older pagans I just said older is all I said.
Mm-hmm.
But you use those terms a lot, and it's something I don't hear the young people like. I remember that was a very common thing. Even though I wasn't that active in the pagan community when I was younger, but you know, I knew them and I was around them because I was a musician, and they were, you know, the sort of, I knew some of the, you know, tattooed, you know, pagan type folks. Mm-hmm. And I was into that myself. What people would say, I remember that was a common thing for people to say, was welcome home or something like that, like if you joined a group or a meetup. And I'm curious, in your experience, this is going to lead into my next question, then I'll let Janice have the rest of them. And of the young generation of pagans and Wiccans coming up, do you find them less cordial? Or do you think, in some ways I think it's gotten better, though. I'll drop that there. But I'm curious what you think about some of the young manners of some of the younger 20-something pagans that you run into online or elsewhere.
Well, let's see. I have to say I am not as online in the forums and things as I used to be, because for a long time, I won't even say with this generation, I think for a long time, the online world has not been cordial. So I kind of gave up on that a long time ago. Let's see, I'd say it's a mixed bag, because I'm not going to blame it on the young people, because I've met some really, really lovely young people, actually. And I think that I've met people in our age group, actually, who are new to Wicca, who are kind of awful. So,
right.
I met those too. Yeah, I think any population can suck equally given the opportunity. But I think certainly there has been, I think because access is so much easier than it was, you know, access is so much easier than it was, say, when we were coming up, that people perhaps are more presumptive than they were when we were younger. People don't think about privacy issues as much, maybe. You know, but I have to say, throughout the many years that I've been doing this, you know, I've had, I don't give out my phone number anymore because, you know, I got tired of people calling me at midnight because they assumed that because I was a pagan, I would be up, you know, reveling at midnight or something.
Right.
You know.
I think, to be more accurate, I probably shouldn't have used, because I broke one of my own rules. I often say on my show not to be so doom and gloom about young people. You know, sometimes the older generation always think, oh, the young one, oh, they're messed up. Really, but I should have probably said it in the modern era. Might have been more accurate.
Ah, okay. Get off my lawn.
But anyway, I hand you back to Janice. You good?
Okay.
Okay. Student-wise, have you run into some of your students that are pagan or pagan-friendly or Wiccan? Has anybody talked about that?
Zero. Occasionally I do run across somebody who was in an African diaspora religion. I do run across somebody who is, you know, practices Yoruban religion or something like that. But what is far more common is the kind of experience I was talking about earlier, although it's much more Christian, where I'll have people ask me questions, and I don't know if they're hearing this from their pastors at church or what's happening, but they'll say, you know, on the first day of class in African art, someone will raise their hand and say, is it true that they worship the devil in Africa? You know, things like that.
That's very unfortunate.
You know, that they're asking those questions, and I think they're probably not coming up with that on their own. They're getting that from somebody, you know.
Yeah, somebody's whispered something in their ear.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So it makes me really sad. So I try to take a very academic, professional approach and, you know, say this is what people do, and it's a different religion than you might have, you know, but this is their point of view,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Well, different doesn't mean that it's scary or monstrous or anything.
Right.
We have to get out of that mindset, that different means. Something scary.
Exactly.
I can't actually. So, are you planning to do more tarot cards?
I'm thinking about
another deck.
I have a deck that the earlier deck that I did that is goes with a storybook, and I've actually been making some handmade storybooks that I'm going to be selling at the Reader's Studio in April, which is a big tarot conference in New York that happens every year at the end of April, and it's really awesome, by the way. So you should totally Google it if you're into tarot.
Okay.
It's given by the Tarot School. So I'm going to be doing that, so I'm sort of recreating that and revamping that. To do another tarot deck, I'm not sure, because that's 78 paintings, and that's a really big commitment. And I tend to, when I'm painting, do sort of as I'm guided, you know, spiritually.
Well, yes, Daniel was talking about that earlier, how, you know, it takes a lot of guts and glory and imagination and inspiration to do a tarot deck, because there's 78 cards that you have to do. Or in Kevin Barr's case, how many?
110.
So that's a lot
that's
of
just staggering. Yeah,
that's a lot of inspiration to come up with that.
Yeah. Now there are, you know, some artists in the tarot community like Robert Place and Ciro Marchetti who do tarot decks as a matter of course. It seems like they're always coming out with a new deck. But I haven't thought of, I am actually thinking of doing a deck that is made up generally of about 36 cards. It's called a Lenormand deck. And it's based
Very interesting. Can you tell us more about it?
Yeah, she is, Madame Lenormand was Napoleon's tarot reader. And she actually had, apparently she was really accurate and very good, and he relied on her, and I think a number of other people did as well. And she, spent time in the Bastille because of her association with him. But in any case, she hand-painted her own deck of cards, and so the originals don't even exist, actually. What exists are people's recreations of them, but I've been thinking about doing something like that. I need to find out more about them, though, so we'll see when. I'm doing my information gathering right now,
and
see what comes out of that, yeah.
I see. Well, I've got your cards here. Now, I am not affiliated with your different card placements. I just read them this morning, and they have already left my head. But I could definitely do a past, present, future if you want me to shuffle your own cards.
Oh, okay. Who are we doing it for?
For you.
For me? Okay, cool.
Yeah, okay. Daniel's going to hold the phone for a minute.
Hold on. Do what you got to do.
Okay.
She is shuffling the cards right now. It's a beautiful evening. I'm cracking the door open, actually. She is shuffling.
Ask her if she wants me to continue to shuffle.
All right, tell her when to stop shuffling.
She can stop shuffling.
Okay.
There we go. Okay.
She was kind of mid-shuffle.
I was mid-shuffle.
Okay. And she is now dividing them into three piles. Pick from pile one, two, or three.
I would like the middle pile.
Middle pile.
So that would be two, probably.
Yes. And then pile one or three.
Three,
okay. And we know what the final answer is.
Oh, I think you're going to like this, actually.
That's good.
The first one is the Gaia.
which actually is one of my favorite ones since this morning. But it's the African American woman, or and you know, she's in the sun. She's got a blue sun hat, and she's surrounded by either marigolds or sunflowers. And she's in her sundress, and she's thinking, or she's looking like everything is being well, or everything is being happy, everything is being joyful. The chariot, well, you know, chariot is, in my opinion, a card of choices that you could either go, in my opinion, there's a road that you have to go down to where you have information that needs to be sought, and you need to work on this information. So you're going down, and you're going down the road with a lion in your card. It looks like a lion. And you're charging through to get that information. And the last one is the Two of Cups, which is usually a very good loving card. I know you're married, and never met Sean yet, but I know you're married, and it's a good relationship because I haven't heard differently. So I feel that all three of them together, the past being things are rosy, and from your past adventures and your past drawings and your past blessings, the Gaia comes up. The chariot, there's always room for more endeavors and for more art, for more awakenings,
for
more strength. And the Two of Cups, definitely a lovely relationship, a relationship built on hope and desire and love.
Oh, thank you. That's very nice.
Oh, okay. Hold on.
Now, I can see the Two of Cups at the end also, because cups are as well associated with art. They're not always romantic like love. And since you are an artist, Two of Cups can maybe mean maybe you're going to team up with somebody soon that'll be an interesting artistic partner, perhaps.
Okay.
Sean, do art?
He does, interestingly, he has a BFA in illustration.
Maybe teaming up with her hubby.
Right.
Yeah, he doesn't do a lot with it, unfortunately. I usually, every year we do a Yule card together. And I usually start it, and then he's a detail guy because he likes to do really detailed stuff. So maybe I can get him to do some detailed stuff.
Cool.
Yeah.
So what did you think of my reading? Like I said, I just got the cards, and I didn't really mold myself into it, but I thought I did well.
I thought so. I liked your interpretation of the chariot. You know, I thought that was good because I see it as a card of asking yourself, are you driving the vehicle or what's driving you? You know.
I like that. Yeah, we both like that. So.
And I like all the positive cards, especially, of course.
I read in the book, I did read this, that where you're having a reading and it's not going as well as you think it's going, always leave on a positive note. Now, that's not I'm saying that you're not a positive person and positive things happen to positive people, but it's always good to interpret as much as possible towards positive.
Right, try to give the person something something constructive to take away from it. Definitely.
What can be seen as a negative card in whatever you're reading from, whether it's, or any divination for that matter, is to remember it to be a learning experience.
So it's not doom and gloom.
Oh, no.
So sometimes when people, they don't know that much about divination, they go, that's a horrible card, you know. And it's reversed. Oh, my God, you know.
Oh, yeah, I guess it's a reverse.
Like, no, that's just something to work on, basically.
Right. See, I see the cards, or I always tell people, see it as they're tools, you know. And these are signposts, and these are things that you can use to, you know, turn around, you know, and to, you know, fix if you so desire.
which is part of our purpose for being here, is to learn
That's
and
great.
Progress in our many lives and to fix the things we need to fix about ourselves.
Yes, definitely.
And my friend Evan put it nicely, and he said, Evan Pass used to be a host, our Thursday host, for it was a show called Zarayana Radio. In fact, he read from the Thoth deck. He didn't do a reading show necessarily. He did once or twice, but he did read from that Crowley deck. It was the first one he ever learned from. Very complex and interesting deck. So, but to him, that one
was
normal. It was normal to him because that's just what he started with. His mom was a tarot reader. He was part Lebanese, and his mom was in the tarot and all that. But he said that the cards are like little mirrors that are reflecting back messages that your soul is sending, that they're messages that you already know, and it's just reflecting them back to you, was one way that he used to put it, which I thought that was an interesting
way. That is a really nice way to put it.
And
I like that.
I'm curious, since we're kind of winding down, we're getting close to the end of our show, and there was, being an artist yourself, there was a great documentary that I saw on the BBC, and I don't know if you've seen it or not. If not, I definitely think you would really enjoy it, considering the things you're into and that you like. And it was called How Art Made the World.
Oh, I have that on DVD, yes.
Oh, isn't it, wasn't that a great documentary?
Oh, yeah. I love the way they find connections between things, which I think is terrific.
Yeah. And its beginning premise being that they were saying the big artistic images that were made, they used to think that civilization was formed like this. And I'll make this extremely short. They were saying it was first with the big cities and the big civilizations, and then religion came. This was saying that, no, they had spiritual belief systems and then wanted to build something around it. So they built the entire structures all around their spiritual belief systems. And that was why, as well as for making beer, civilization was basically founded.
Yeah.
Stopping to train and make statues.
We had the beer show already.
Yeah, we did. We actually did one of those shows, a show about a beer forming civilization as well. Well, back.
That's great.
But, okay, so you saw that, so I don't have to explain that one to you. But
yeah, that is a great one.
It was a really good documentary.
Yeah, like I said, I love that he makes connections between the ancient world and the modern world, too. I think that that's really cool. And, you know, I think that I try to find things that the students will get excited about. And I really like, you know, when he went and looked at Aboriginal art and ancient Australian work, and then, you know, went and actually talked to modern-day Aboriginal peoples who are still making work that looks like that. You know, I thought it was really cool.
Absolutely. An important thing about all things like that I think is such an important lesson for people in every aspect of life, whether it's politics, whether it's a lesson to be learned in life personally, whether it's artistic, whether it's philosophical or spiritual, is that one of my favorite simple sayings is not everything was invented last Tuesday. There are so many things that have always been with us, and all of these flaws that have always been with us. And it's, we see a problem, and I'm not going to, I was almost about to drift into a political issue, but this isn't a political show. But we see a problem in society, and we think it's brand new, and it's not.
Right.
Just like our spiritual arguments that go on between one religious sect or the other. And people, none of this is new. These moral arguments, none of it. It's all just relative to where you are and when you are. But they've all happened in some similar form or other.
Yeah, and if only we would, you know, look at the past a bit more and learn from it.
Absolutely, and that's well put. And as an artist, and as someone yourself, I meant, not myself, but as yourself being an artist, I'm more of an audio artist. I do music and such.
So do I.
And Janice is musical as well. You can see as you dig in, and especially with the tarot, you can see, as you're someone who's not only a painter, but who has painted tarot cards, they represent the archetypes that are universal. So I sometimes even say, if you study the tarot properly, it'll actually tend to make you, like, not racist and things like this. Like, you'll start seeing everybody as the same. When you start reading for people, you're like, oh, this person's doing this. This one's doing, oh, they're doing that again, you know. Mm-hmm. And these universal types. But anyway, we're kind of coming down to it. Thank you very much for joining us, Helena.
Oh, thanks for having me. It was awesome.
And I would like to give you the chance right now to
plug
the things that you'd like to share here, your website, any other efforts.
Okay, well, thank you. Yeah, my website is www.mythandwonder.com. And you can also friend me on Facebook. I am there as Helena Aisline, which I will spell A-I-S-L-I-N. And I also have a Fellowship of the Fool Facebook page, which I promise to get better at updating. And if you're interested in ordering the Fellowship of the Fool, there is a page for the Fellowship on my website as well. And also you can check out all of the major arcana cards there as well. And there's information about the book and anything else. You know, shoot me a message on Facebook or contact me through my website. I guess that's everything. You can also find me at the Assembly of the Sacred Wheel website, which is www.sacredwheel.org.
Okay. Very good. And here's Denise for one last.
Thank you so much for allowing Daniel and I to interview you tonight. I really appreciate
my pleasure.
That. Yes. And
thank you.
Huh?
I just said thank you.
Oh, no problem. And don't forget to like me on Goddess Janice, because I just did that on Saturday. That's very new.
Okay, cool. I'll go look for it now.
All right, cool.
Well, thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
Have a great evening. It was
a
pleasure.
Great evening.
And remember, everybody, that the mysteries and possibilities of the universe are closer to Main Street than you may have ever imagined. Have a great evening.